ever with COVID.
Yes. Okay, I think it's recording, but sure. I will put another one just in case.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, we are recording now. Wait a minute. Okay, Leopold, thanks for coming and welcome to Blekin. So I'm going to start with one question. What is going on Nouvelle-Calédonie? Yes, what's going on? Tell sure. us about it.
Yeah, thank you, Viviana, and congratulations on the radio program. Yeah, so perhaps the very, very first thing I will say is that for me, the name of that country is Kanaky, more than New Caledonia, which is the name that indigenous Kanak people have decided to give to their own country, although they're not, you know, they go from one to the other very flexibly. But what's happening in Kanaky at the moment is a revolt, an indigenous revolt against the French colonial structures. But this revolt is being met with two waves of suppression that works extremely well together. One is from the French state itself, which has deployed thousands of extra militaries in the country, has declared the state of emergency, and we can come back to the history of that particular legislation if you want later. And has been putting a certain amount of activists in under house arrest. And then there's the part of the suppression that comes from the settlers themselves. They've been organizing themselves in militias that are pretty much guarding the access to many white neighborhood of the main city of the country, Nouméa. Which is mostly where settlers are living within the country, and they've been shooting at people. They've been killing young Kanak people. We don't know how many people just yet because this number is being kept under a very heavy lead cap as to not exacerbate the very legitimate anger from young Kanak people, but we know it's been at least three, but we suspect it's much more, unfortunately, and things are still going on, so it could even get even worse. So this is the situation we're witnessing right now, and the airport has been closed as well indefinitely, so no one can access the country. So we are also trying our best to gather, what the reality, is on the ground with our comrades and relatives there, but, it's not always easy.
Yes, thanks. As I told you, here in Italy, we don't have much news about it. I was just checking this morning and there were no articles on the newspaper. So it's really, it's not easy to find any news. Can you tell us about the law about the right to vote to the white people living in Kanaky?
Yeah. So the piece of legislation that sort of triggered such revolt, which I should say, you know, it started to be talked about in the French media when young Kanaks started to, put fire on cars and really express their anger through this revolt. But it's important to say that even though those are, as far as I'm concerned, very legitimate actions, there had been also other forms of revolt that took the form of massive gatherings of Kanak people in Nouméa, which again is not really is mostly like a settler city. So there are many Kanak people living in Nouméa, but it is not innocent for so many thousands of Kanak people coming to Noumea to protest this law, and with many, many flags. And I think there was about 20,000 Kanak people at some point, and in a country of 270,000 people, 40% only of which of whom are Kanak. So it must be something like one Kanak person out of 10 in the country was at that gathering. So it's absolutely massive. You need to imagine in Italy, it would mean like having half a million people of a very certain demographics protesting something. And so the piece of legislation itself that is being protested both by those gathering as well as by the revolt of young Kanak is what we've been calling the unfrozing, which I think is an interesting term, the unfrozing of the legislative body, electoral body, I apologize, the electoral body of who is deemed a citizen of the country, essentially. I mean, even though it doesn't require, it's not the nomenclature of the colonial state, because the colonial state will say rather who is deemed to be authorized to vote for the what they call the provincial elections in Kanaky, New Caledonia. Essentially it's saying what this would allow would be the possibility for everyone who came in the country since 1995 and have remained there for over 10 years to be able to vote to local elections and therefore potentially decide the fate of the country as well. And I suppose you'd be probably interested in hearing why it was frozen to begin with. And that is a result of a long historical process. But it's interestingly enough, we might want to do it, almost counter chronologically, like start with the now and then kind of go down, to recently, three referendums that were aimed to decide whether the country would have whether the country would reach a full sovereignty or not, and the first one was won by the anti-independentist, but with a much smaller margin than they expected to be. The second one, the margin was even smaller, and so there was a lot of pressure on the third one that could have led to the independence of the country. But it was, the process was deliberately accelerated by the French state and the anti-independentist settler parties in order for the Kanak independentist parties to not have the time to very much organize for it. And it was right in the middle of COVID in 2021. So Kanak people had declared a national mourning for everyone who had been dying from COVID. And therefore they refused to participate to that referendum. So this one could not possibly be considered as a valid referendum on the fate of the country. And then if I continue going backwards, the fact that those referendums existed to begin with was because of an accord signed in 1998 called Noumea Accord, which sort of like established the terms through which the country would operate politically for the coming 35 years, for the coming 25 years, I'm sorry. Built what they called a common destiny between settlers, but you know, settlers who've been there for a very long time, some of whom were brought forcefully as part of a penal colony in the 19th century, a little bit like Australia, the way the British had done with Australia. So there was an understanding around that time in the late 90s that like Kanak people essentially made huge concession to agree that they alone would not be the sole deciders on the sovereignty of the country, but would invite other communities of the country, including the one that were unbelievably racist and had also participated in massacres from earlier, but I'll get to it in just a second. That indeed they could take the decision together, but that of course involved the fact that it should be people who had been there for a long time. I think if Kanak Party had their way back then, it would have been people who would have come to the country at least before the 1970s, when there was a very deliberate effort from the French state to bring more white people or even non-white people as settlers to Kanaky. This is something that one of your former guests, Saïd Bouamama, wrote very well in one of his books called Faire du Blanc.
What do you mean when you say people who were not white? I mean, I know that a lot of militants from Algeria have been sent there as a punishment when it was a penal colony.
Yeah, so this was much earlier. This was in the late 19th century, and it was indeed at least at large, Maghrebi have been sent there, but more specifically Kabyle, so Amazigh Algerians, after a massive revolt in 1871 against the French colonizers. But here I'm describing more 100 years later, the way, or 80 to 100 years later, the way the French state tried to make the settling of New Caledonia easier for white people from France, but also or non-white people from France for that matter, but also from still colonized Vietnam, for example, from Japan, from Java, from Tahiti, which is still also colonized by France, from Wallis and Futuna, which is also still colonized by France. There's more Wallisian, it's a small country, but still there's more Wallisian in Kanaky than there are in Wallis. And so for many, many years, all of those communities that were non-Kanak were fundamentally anti-liberation. And this is something that's maybe a little bit more complicated today, which also makes it interesting. Like there's more now supporters to Kanak liberation in the country than there used to be 40 years later. And so this is where going back a little bit further in time, when because these accords in 1998 followed one in 1988 that ended 4 years of massive indigenous insurrection that really brought the French state to a state of panic, forcing it to assassinate one of the main Kanak leader, Edouard Machoro, for example. So that's when the Kanak and Socialist National Liberation Front, the FLNKS, that still exists today, that's when it was formed, and that's the parties that organized the coalition of parties, actually, I should say, that organized this insurrection from 1984 to 1998. That was again like really putting the colonial state in a high difficulty. But there had been during those 4 years such traumatic massacres from either the settlers themselves or the French state, and the one that is the most famous one, and even in France that really doesn't have the right level of knowledge on the history of Kanaki, even this massacre is quite well remembered from people at least my age and older, which was in 1988 in Uvea, when 19 activists, Kanak activists, were killed by the army. And so that trauma led to the signatures of those peace accord, you could say, and led to a historical sequence that was deemed by the French state as having ended with that third referendum. And this is why this law is coming, this sort of reform, this constitutional reform that would unfroze the electoral body come now, is because 3 years ago, this third referendum was, as far as France is concerned, but I already told you that as far as Kanak people are concerned, it's not the case. But as far as the French state was concerned, this third referendum marked the end of the Nouméa Accord. And for the settlers, it basically said that Kanaki had to stay French forever. So there needs to be a new system, so to speak.
Yes, thanks. Would you describe the situation in Kanaky as an apartheid situation between the indigenous people and the Kanak people and the white settlers living there?
It's complicated because, you know, the answer could be just as much yes or no. It really depends how close we are looking at the thing. What's for sure is there is a non-official yet extremely active segregation between the settlers, who again are not necessarily all white, but this again for the non-white settlers, it also involved like an extra layer of complexity, let's say, but and Kanak indigenous people. There's also a massive discrepancy of wealth, also because many people who settle in New Caledonia are being offered like very high salaries to actually relocate there. It's also a very expensive country. It's more expensive than France.
Really?
Yeah, it is. It really is. Yeah, but as it's often the case in this sort of like colonial situation where you're extremely dependent on the economy of a country that is not yours, and to import goods, you know, you have to go through boats and all that. So it's so it's an extremely expensive country to live in, and then a lot of the Kanak population is actually living in high precariousness. But what's for sure is that the space of life of Kanak people in Kanaky is still very much the scale of the tribe, what we call the tribe, and those tribes are exactly reservations, just like the way indigenous people in North America have been placed in reservation. So I don't know if apartheid in the sort of the way that it might connect the history of the country in relationship to South Africa or even Palestine. I don't know whether this comparison is productive or not, but it's definitely, and it's not exactly that, but it's definitely not that.
Yeah, I wanted to know if there was a spatial in space segregation, for example, white neighborhood or not white, let's say settlers neighborhood and indigenous neighborhood, like in every colonization, like Fanon said, or if there was a kind of mixité between people, but I think not.
Yeah. I would say that the most recent settlers, so those we will for sure, when the country is independent, those who will go back to France, live almost exclusively in Nouméa and its peripheries. The sort of long-term settlers, live in Nouméa, but also on the west coast of the Great Earth, and have, you know, for some of them live in a way that is also extremely similar to cowboys in the US. So again, I think perhaps if we are to pick a historical precedent to talk about this. I think the U.S. is not a bad precedent to talk about reservation and cowboys and all that. And then since this insurrection in the 80s, the east coast of the Great Earth is mostly inhabited by Kanak people, because they managed to gain back some land back in the 80s, as well as in the smaller islands and the Great Earth, it's mostly also Kanak. So as much as people live in economic precariousness everywhere, there is something, of course, much easier when the First Nations are living in like an entire island or something like that. Like, at least you can sort of like organize yourself at the scale of this island. Whereas in Noumea, it can be extremely violent, this segregation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, while you were talking, I was thinking about how the citizenship has been used as a device to control, cast a control upon the colonies. For example, I think that people who are living now in the département d'outre-mer, territoire d'outre-mer, they may thought that having a citizenship would be an advantage. So how the French Empire has used the citizenship and whatever comes within to elude people. They may thought they could be independent and having a citizenship, but this is not happening. France is one of the last few countries that still has colonies on this planet.
Yeah, except for the colonies themselves, I guess, like Australia, the US, Canada, and
yeah, of course.
But I agree. But something that we tend to do quite easily when we live in France itself is to put all the so-called overseas countries in the same group, when actually each of them have their own specificities. So there's, of course, those in the Caribbean, which are Martinique and Guadeloupe, which, of course, their entire history is built on the genocide of indigenous people and the transatlantic slave trade, as well as Guyana, French Guyana, where there's also indigenous nations fighting French colonialism still today. There's a part of the Comoros that is still colonized by France called Mayotte, like one island of Comoros. There's Réunion Island that is also another sort of case in the Indian Ocean. There's Tahiti and what, you know, France called French Polynesia, which is absolutely a massive territory in the middle of Oceania, and which, like, people probably know that France did over 30 years of nuclear testing. And then there's Kanaky itself, which is the last real settler colony in which indigenous people have been placed in minority, replaced by settlers. So each of those have their own history. All of them share that 1946 was a particular moment where what we call the Code de l'Indigène, like the sort of the way that colonized people were legislated by a different status than French people, was abolished by then, and so people became French. In Algeria, it's a much more complicated story, but in those countries I just named, people did go from being so-called indigène, and indigène is not exactly indigenous. I mean, it of course means indigenous, but in the way we mean indigenous in English, but I don't know. Anyway, it will be in Italian, so you will.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. Okay. But so they went from being indigène to French. So I also don't want to downplay the fact that, you know, it's what it used to be pre-46 was absolutely appalling in every possible way. Let's say the access to the sort of colonial citizenship certainly did not abolish colonialism itself. Far from it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. And why, in your opinion, France Okay, let's change the question, because sure. I have another one. I was just thinking, how l'état d'urgence has been used in these later years, because we saw it in 2015 after for the terrorism. We are seeing now for the banlieue, and we saw now in Kanaky with a massive income of military people taking a 24-hour journey to land on Kanaky Island. So how is still being used l'état d'urgence? Is it still, I'm thinking French, is it bound to the colonial administration made by French, for example, in Algeria? Because we know that a lot of people, for example, being enrolled in the police, they were already police in the colonial state during the late 60s and 70s. So, what is the lien entre
ça? So the good news is I wrote a book literally on that. So
that's why I'm talking to you about.
So it is my contention indeed that all those different sort of space time that the French state of emergency mobilized are all connected through what we may call the French colonial continuum. And the French state of emergency was drafted in 1955, to very much counter the beginning of the Algerian revolution that will, you know, lead to, 7 years later to the independence of Algeria and its liberation from French colonialism. So it was very much drafted in, for a state of war against an anti-colonial movement. It was then reapplied. So it was applied in one form or another throughout the Algerian Revolution, to keep it simple. It was then used in Kanaky in 1985 at the beginning of that insurrection I was talking about earlier. And so it very much also make visible the sort of common history that colonized Algeria and colonized Kanaky have with each other, including, you know, you talked about how some Algerians were deported to Kanaky in the late 19th century. But I would say some of the French settlers who left Algeria in 1962, some of them actually moved to Kanaky and sort of were able to find a not completely dissimilar conditions of life than they used to have in Algeria. And then this state of emergency was applied in 2005. There's always a five somehow at the beginning. It's like 1955, 1985, 2005, against, and something that I'm old enough to remember firsthand myself, which is a pretty huge revolt in the banlieue, so in those racialized working class neighborhoods in France, following the death of two teenagers, Ziad Benan and Bouna Traoré, very similar to what we've witnessed last June after the police murder of Nahel Merzouk. So I'm sure many of your listeners will be much more familiar with that history, so you can imagine something extremely similar. And then indeed, as you said, we had 2 years of state emergency in November 2015 after the bloody attacks in Paris that killed over 200 people. And you know, instead of, I mean, the state of emergency was not really used to sort of dismantle any sort of, like, you know, what the French state called terrorist organization or stuff like that, but actually much more to trigger an even higher degree of violence against French Muslims, in particular, French Muslims, with a staggering amount of house searches, like about 5,000, and a staggering amount of house arrest as well, about 500, of French Muslims, so who had to go three times a day or twice a day to the local police station to show they are there, and without the possibility of leaving their home at night. And so now we are seeing a new application of the state of emergency in Kanaky And as I mentioned earlier, with similarly curfews, house arrest, house searches, and all that.
Okay, thanks. And in your opinion, why France is still behaving this way? I mean, in the last few years, we saw a lot of movement, anti-colonialist movement, in the lands that were colonies of the French, for example, Senegal, and also, of course, Niger, which has been famous this past summer. So since we can feel there is a new consciousness among this population, these people, why is still France keeping their hands on colonized lands instead of changing the relationship, the political relationship, which is not happening? Because, for example, in Africa, France is still very much present in the little things, in the money, in the banks, the internal politic, in the outer politics, and also, for example, L'Orange, c'est la compagnie du téléphone, c'est partout.
And the sponsor of the can.
et voilà, yeah. Bien sûr.
Total as well.
Total as well, everywhere. So,
yeah.
Is it something changing between the relationship between la métropole et les colonies, or everything is still the same?
Yeah. So here again, I think it's important to also respect the specificities of each place. But it's true that there is what we might want to call a block that goes from Mauritania to Gabon or to the Republic of Congo that we can call very legitimately a France-Afrique, where indeed the money is still the franc, CFA. The money is still very much dependent on the Banque de France. I mean, there's an entire sort of there's entire structures that indeed keep a very close tie on all of those countries, including Guinea-Bissau, I think, that has also the franc, but for other reasons. Only Guinea-Conakry actually managed to liberate itself from it. But precisely that's because, and that's something that I've been writing about in the book, it's precisely because in 1958 and 1960, at the core of the counter-revolution in Algeria, France knew that it had to find a new way to be a colonial power in Africa. I mean, on the African continent, and sort of like granted the independence to some local elites that were going to side by France at UN and that were going to very much side with French interest and let France still handle some military or economic aspects in the region, as we've seen, with, of course, variations. I mean, Gabon and Ivory Coast being, of course, the best student in the class in that matter. But we see how in Cameroon, for example, the real anti-colonial movement was being denied independence. It was given to like the sort of the Francophile elite. And then the Francophile elite the new state of Cameroon then led a war against the actual anti-colonial, militants. And France helped fight that war. So we can see how this has been happening with also a lot of extractivism involved. I mean, you talked about Niger. That's where the uranium is being extracted. I mean, talking about Burkina Faso, Niger, Chad, and all that, the problem is that now we also see that there's new sort of new economic powers and very imperialist powers involved, such as Russia, which is, you know, something that as an internationalist myself, I cannot possibly support, even though that's not really I'm not really the person who can have a legitimate opinion on the matter, but I don't think but at least it's true that those countries have managed somehow to create a different dynamic vis-a-vis the former colonizer that was still like the neo-colonial power. And the best organization in France to study this, the France-Afrique, is called Survie. It's even its founder, Xavier Derchaves, that had coined the term France-Afrique. And they have been doing this really great work with Kanaky, as they've been solicited by some Kanaky independentist organizations to basically establish a report of what would be, if Kanaky were to become independent, what would be the traps not to fall into in the sort of agreement signed with France to avoid these sort of neo-colonial conditions. So I kind of want to do a shootout to this organization, Survie, because they've really drew the line between West Africa, Francophone West Africa, and Kanaky in a very convincing way, and not just in a way of saying, oh yeah, French colonialism, so we can talk about, you know, we can talk about Guadeloupe, Senegal, Réunion and Kanaky in the same sentence without problem, when actually I feel we need to be much more respectful of the specificity of each place, but in that case it really worked.
Yeah, sure. I think every country has his specific, but I think that when it came to Mali and then Burkina Faso, they kind of way changed the narrative about the colonization, and this was important for Senegal, for example.
Sure. Yeah.
It showed that there was another way to have relationship with the mother country, and it's
the mother country. Oh wow!
Yeah, mother country is to us. Is definitely. Now I think that the colonialism is much. It's economic, of course, but also it's so cultural in this moment.
The Institut Français is very strong in that. Yeah.
Everywhere. Also, the way you speak French in Africa defines your class. If you are upper class, you have a real French accent. Yeah. If you are from the hood, you don't have a real accent because you didn't go to the French school.
If I may, we have a beautiful, beautiful text in the most recent issue of The Funambulist by Marie Ranzanour, who's a Malagasy author who lives in France and who writes specifically about that, in how French as a language, even though the neo-colonial grip on Madagascar is a little bit less strong than in West Africa, the French as a language is still like a very, yeah, it still structures the Malagasy society in many ways, and she writes it absolutely beautifully, so I highly recommend that text.
I will read it, for sure. So I think we can stop here. It's been 37 minutes. Do you have any recommendation, any profile we can follow to have updates for Kanaky?
Yeah, I mean, in English, I mean, I think in English it's easy because there's less. but my good friend Anaïs Duong-Pediga is both on Twitter and Instagram trying to always translate the struggle in many ways. In The Funambulist, we've had like a good amount, like a small dozen, a little bit less than a dozen pieces on the question as well, that people who are able to read English more than French would maybe find useful. And then for people who read French, then I think, you know, I cited Survie, which is really great, but also I think there's a certain amount of Kanak activists in Kanaky who are, you know, using Instagram or the social media in very helpful ways, and reflecting on the situation, and in particular reflecting on the narratives that is being carried to characterize the situation. So yeah, I think I think there's, you know, there's definitely ways without necessarily doing like a full breakdown of like, oh, you should follow this, and then you'll know. I think there are ways to whoever is truly willing to engage with, to truly engage with the struggle to have good, information and good ways to enter it, so to speak.
Okay, sure. Then you give me the list, please, because yeah. I still spell the surname of Anaïs.
Sure.
Maybe later.
Maybe I'll write it now.